From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. All over the world this week, people watched as the fighting in the Middle East escalated. Last week, we looked at the way the story was playing in the region itself, and this week we'll once again survey the Arab and Israeli coverage, but we'll also reflect on how the story is being told in other parts of the world, including our own.
As we slice and dice the coverage, we find, as in most media analysis, but especially this story, that no observer is truly neutral, that the idea of a solid middle ground from which we can judge others who seem so hopelessly stuck in the bogs of ideology is a myth. So with that said, we turn first to J.J. Goldberg. He's the editor of The Forward, the 109-year-old Jewish newspaper published here in New York. This week, his paper reported on the peculiar silence of bloggers on the political left.
On the right, the bloggers are going on and on about those horrible Muslims, the horrible Arabs. And on the left, there's been an unwillingness to get into it. You don't want to get into the sort of invective you're going to get from your readers, whichever side you take. There's been for years a readiness in the Jewish community to jump down the throat of any journalist who made Israel sound bad. And in the last couple of years, we've seen a comparable readiness on the side of the pro-Palestinian community and the anti-Israel community, I would say, to jump down the throat of people who make Israel look good. So people are afraid to put their toe in the water these days.
Now, you're the editor of The Forward, the oldest Jewish newspaper in the United States. Do you feel conflicted when you cover this story?
I don't feel conflicted. Look, we began as a voice of American socialism. We are still well to the left of center. I identify with the Israeli left. The Israeli left doesn't have any misgivings about the existence of the State of Israel. I've got friends and cousins who are fighting on the front lines, but do not want to continue the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. There are wars that Israel has launched in the last 20 years that I've been opposed to. There are actions Israel has taken that I've been very opposed to. But I don't have any conflicts about supporting the right of Israel to exist within negotiated borders alongside Palestine.
So let's talk about the American coverage. In general, how would you characterize it?
I think at the moment the American press is attempting to be scrupulously balanced. X number of bombs here, X number of rockets there. A story about a family that suffered losses in Lebanon, a story about a family that suffered losses in Israel. But when you look at the death tolls, you have to ask, why is the balance so scrupulous? As we're speaking today, it's Thursday, there were about 300 deaths on the Lebanese side. Almost all of them, except for a dozen or so, were civilians. On the Israeli side, you had about 26 or 28 deaths. Just over half were civilians. So that there's an imbalance in the number of losses. And if you're simply looking at victimization and the human casualties, you would have to ask, why is the Israeli side getting equal time?
So you're saying that when the American media offer equal time to these casualties, they give the corresponding impression that there are equal casualties.
Or that there is a moral balance on both sides.
So what, in your view, accounts for that?
Well, American journalists are accustomed and trained to talk in human terms. Tell me a story. Tell me about a person. Lead it with a face. Lead it with a kid. Lead it with a puppy. So when you have deaths on both sides, you talk about the deaths on both sides. Now, there's a discomfort in the current conflict because the deaths on the Lebanese side are way disproportionate to the deaths on the Israeli side. On the other hand, the provocation on the Israeli side is way disproportionate to the provocation on the Lebanese side. The Israelis were invaded by Hezbollah and are responding to that invasion. So rather than get into a long explanation of history and law, the journalists will attempt to achieve some sort of rough parity by giving equal time to the victims on both sides.
And do you think that is because they don't have the historical memory or the expertise to offer good analysis on their own in the United States?
Well, most newspapers pride themselves on sending out reporters who don't have a commitment or an involvement, which means they don't know that much. You're supposed to pick it up by observing, which is not necessarily a bad thing. The big issue here is that the story changed. Up until 5 years ago, Israel's primary opponent was al-Fatah, the Palestine Liberation Organization, Yasser Arafat, and they were fighting for a Palestinian state. It was about where you put the border between the two peoples. Over the last 3, 4, 5 years, you've seen an increasing role of Muslim fundamentalist militias, both in Lebanon and in the Palestinian territories, whose goal is not to create a Palestinian state, but to eliminate the Israeli state. And we haven't caught up with that. We don't know how to explain the imbalance in that, that it really is at this point, from Israel's point of view, a struggle for survival.
But you'd still say overall that the coverage is largely pro-Israel in the United States.
Well, it's certainly more pro-Israel than the coverage in Europe, in the sense that the American coverage doesn't begin with the assumption that Israel is in the wrong. You have in Europe a sympathy on the left for Muslims, in the sense that in Europe, the Muslim population is the underclass. It's the immigrant class. It's the underdog. And since the Muslim population generally comes with the argument that the creation of Israel was a crime, that is a credible assertion. In this country, it hasn't been up until now a credible assertion to say that the creation of Israel is a crime.
Is this why it's so hard for reporters all around the world to get their arms around this story? Because either stated or unstated, it's based on a certain assumption from which all ethical judgments have to flow. And that's whether or not Israel has a right to exist?
That is a mouthful, but I think that's what it boils down to. If you think Israel has a right to exist, then you create a different universe of descriptions. And if you'd think Israel essentially shouldn't have existed, then you start a completely different universe of assumptions and descriptions. It is possible, conceivably, for a reporter to describe the descriptions on both sides.
That's a very long story that you have to write.
It is. And when you're working in the space of 800 words in between ads, you can't always get the whole story right. You try and quote people from both sides, but there aren't two sides. There's the side in Israel that wants to use all possible force and disregard the rights of others, and there's the side in Israel that wants to use the force necessary to protect Israelis and be done with it. There's the side on the Arab side that wants to restore Palestinian rights alongside Israel, and there's the side on the Arab side that wants to eliminate the state of Israel. There are many, many voices, and it's hard to cover all of them at the same time.
J.J. Goldberg is the editor of the Forward newspaper in New York City.
One of the few winners in this conflict is Arab satellite TV. Qatar-based Al Jazeera and Saudi-based Al Arabiya remain the top news outlets in the region, but the fighting has given new prominence to a number of Lebanese stations, LBC, NBN, Future, and New TV. Once they served only small demographic niches. Now they're a leading source of news from the front line. With their growing stature comes a renewed focus on the political tension within Lebanon as each homegrown broadcaster wrestles with Hezbollah and national unity under fire. Usually these debates are closed to us because of the language barrier, but Mosaic is trying to change all that. The program is a half-hour roundup of the best news from Arab satellite television, translated into English and broadcast to cable subscribers in the United States. Mosaic producer Jamal Dajani joins us now for a look at the TV coverage of the growing war. Jamal, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's begin with Al Jazeera. Two of their correspondents were arrested earlier this week near Haifa, and the Israeli government has been clamping down on how much can be reported from there. Tell me what happened in that incident and how you would characterize Al Jazeera's coverage in Israel in general.
Al Jazeera has been bringing coverage from all different sides. They've had the Israeli generals and political analysts and journalists. They've had Saudis talking there. They've had Kuwaitis. They had Lebanese. And in general, it is the most watched channel. And what happened in that incident is that they were accused of helping the enemy, Hezbollah, identifying the targeted areas. Now, from Al Jazeera perspective, they were saying they weren't doing anything different than other media outlets.
Does Al Jazeera's coverage differ in any way from, for example, Al Arabiya or LBC or the other popular TV news outlets?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is a major difference between, for example, Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya. And Al Arabiya has taken, in fact, in its narrative, the Saudi position. There is more criticism about Nasrallah personally, the persona of Nasrallah. The Nasrallah, the Hezbollah leader. And it's unprecedented for the first time that you have the Saudis early on criticize the actions of Hezbollah and call Nasrallah's actions, in essence, reckless adventurism. Now, the Lebanese, on the other hand, now we have to divide them all, categorize them. You have the Sunnis, the Shiites, the Christians, and they have different tones. The LBC, for example, this is a Christian-operated television network, has been very critical of Nasrallah. They have been very critical that he has dragged them into a war of destruction. Future Television, which is also Sunni, this is a Muslim station, they were very critical also with Hezbollah until yesterday. Yesterday, they had an interview with Hariri, who is the son of the late Prime Minister Rafiq al-Hariri, and he changed his tone a little bit because, you know, after the first 50 bombs has dropped on Beirut, the tone has been changing. Now we're going, you know, the 50 bombs were okay, but 500 bombs are not okay. So now he has been addressing his constituency, in essence, through Future TV and telling them now we have to unite and we'll deal with our differences later.
Jamal, have you seen anything on any of these channels in the last week that has surprised you?
Well, I think what surprised me is what I don't see and how the coverage was done during the Iraqi war. It's a major difference, the absence of many of the channels. Now I'm talking about other than Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya and the Lebanese, there has been an absence of the Jordanians, the Saudis, the Kuwaitis, the channels from the Gulf like the Abu Dhabi and so forth. Seems like they have a very little investment in this war. And I think that's an indication of the split in the opinion from their own governments. I wouldn't say it's the public opinion, but definitely it's the position of the countries.
What about the Iraq war? Has it disappeared from these channels for the duration?
This is a great question. I think in one day I counted over 100 people dead in Iraq. That story didn't even take second, third, fourth. I don't know where it was. It was buried somewhere else. This war in Lebanon, at least for the time being, is causing a major shift in resources as far as the importance of Iraq. And you see it definitely evident in those stations that I'm talking about now, real news stations. Iraq coverage has been dismal.
All right. Well, Jamal, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jamal Dajani is producer of Mosaic, which appears on Link TV.
Coming up, separating the media outlet from the propaganda machine, or not.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Among Arabic language news channels, Al Manar, based in Lebanon, increasingly stands out. Broadcast on TV and radio throughout the Middle East in Arabic, English, French, and Hebrew, it can claim by most counts an audience of more than 10 million a day. Al Manar is owned and operated by Hezbollah, which has waged war with Israel for much of the last 24 years. In fact, Israeli rockets hit Al-Manar soon after this latest battle began, momentarily knocking it off the air and furthering a debate about the line between targeting the media and the militants. But the U.S. government felt no confusion when in 2004 it banned Al-Manar from broadcasting to the U.S. as the first station to be legally designated a terrorist entity. Later, the station was banned in much of Europe, despite its growing status in the region as must-see TV. For Arab audiences today, Al-Manar is the place to learn the latest on where Hezbollah rockets are falling and where they might soon fall. According to NPR's Deborah Amos, now in Damascus, Syria, the station has acquired a reputation for delivering the most factual propaganda.
The reason that so many Syrians tell me that they watch it is because they think it is the most accurate when you want to know what's going on in southern Lebanon. Nasrallah himself, the Hezbollah leader, has a reputation of being more honest than any other leader in the Arab world. I was with a translator today who said to me, you know, if I was looking at a bowl of yogurt that was white and Nasrallah told me that it was beige, I'd look again to be sure.
Wow.
That they keep that reputation, they guard that reputation, because it is their claim to legitimacy. They tell you what they're going to do, and then they do it. And that has been true since this conflict began. Soon after it did begin, Nasrallah went on television and said that they had big surprises. And those big surprises were missiles that landed further into Israel. They had a capacity to hit further into Israel than anyone knew. Western intelligence, Israeli intelligence, Lebanese intelligence.
Sometimes people call a station more accurate because it tells them what they want to hear in the way they want to hear it, not necessarily because the facts are more often correct. What do you think is the case with Al-Manar?
I think that there's a little of that, Brooke. A couple of weeks ago, the Arab world was absolutely in a lather about the World Cup. People were cheering their teams and staying up all night to watch the games. There is a bit of that in what we are watching now. Much of the Arab world is cheering along for Hezbollah. They have given the Israelis a bloody nose, and many people here like that. And so many of them have switched to Al-Manar because they want to be sure that their team wins. And their team is giving them the best rendition of what is going on the battlefield. It's a nationalist broadcast. It keeps its facts fairly straight, but there's a pretty heavy dose of propaganda in it, and people here want to see that.
How much of the Al-Manar newscast have you heard are polemics, and how much are news and information, or are those two things pretty much inseparable?
I think that they are inseparable. There are plenty of propaganda videos that run in between the news, where you see Hezbollah fighters in uniform marching around in the hills, running, with their weapons ready. Lots of swelling music, intercut with destruction in Lebanon and casualties in Israel. Now, they're leaving out a great deal of the story about the destruction of the country and their part and the part that they played in it by capturing two Israeli soldiers and sparking this whole war. That is not part of Al-Manar's coverage.
Now, Al-Manar's broadcast facilities were hit by Israeli bombs on July 13th, and yet the station remained on the air. Do you know what happened there?
I don't, but they have used their channel as a psyops war against the Israelis. They know very well that Arabic speakers in Israel are monitoring that broadcast, as does every Western embassy, certainly here in Damascus. So I have to speculate that Al-Manar officials and Hezbollah officials knew that their television station would be one of the first targets and took precautions to make sure that they could get back on the air, which they did very quickly. In fact, there was a Israeli announcement that they had hit Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah's headquarters, and he very quickly went on the air to say, no, they didn't, and he had been untouched. It was a very grainy picture. They were broadcasting from some transmitter that they had set up on this emergency basis, but they were able to get back up on the air. And as far as people here were concerned, that was a victory for Hezbollah, that they were able to get back up on the air, even though the Israelis had targeted them.
So the credibility that Al-Manar has doesn't include offering, say, the perspective from both sides of the conflict. They're not going to present the Israeli view, for instance. And though they may show pictures of Haifa, do they actually have correspondents in Israel?
It's a preposterous idea. However, there are correspondents from other satellite stations who are on the ground. It's not all that unusual that Al-Manar doesn't have the Israeli perspective. Since television came on the air in the Arab world, that did not appear on state-run televisions at all. Al Jazeera broke that mold by bringing Israeli Arabic-speaking State Department commentators on the air. So the idea of having the Israeli perspective is very new.
Deb, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brooke.
NPR's Deborah Amos joined us from Damascus, Syria.
Last week, Susan Caskey gave us a quick tour of what was being said in editorials out of Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, and Israel. But considering that the Shiite militant group Hezbollah is framing the Lebanon attack as a showdown between Israel and the entire Muslim world, we wondered how Muslims outside the immediate region are reacting to the hostilities. So Susan is back with papers from Pakistan, Indonesia, Algeria, and Malaysia. And the bottom line, she says, is that editorialists are hopping mad. From The Week magazine, Susan Caskey, welcome back to OTM.
Thanks for having me.
Hopping mad. Start, please, in Pakistan.
In Pakistan, which you would expect would be covering the fallout from the Bombay bombings of 2 weeks ago, which India blamed Pakistan for, instead of that, Pakistani editorials are filled with denunciations of Israel and of the United States. There are lots of calls for Muslims to rise up and support Hezbollah and support the Lebanese. There is plenty of criticism of the Arab League for having done very little. The Arab League met and did their usual, well, we condemn this and we refer it to the UN Security Council. One editorial in a Pakistani paper called Islam says that if the Muslim leaders fail to realize their responsibilities and do something, they will not only create severe difficulties for the Islamic world, but will also endanger the existence of their governments.
So that's a shot across the bow at Musharraf, but I guess also more directly at Saudi Arabia and Egypt.
Saudi Arabia has come in for lots of criticism for its condemnation of Hezbollah. Essentially, it's seen as having blamed Hezbollah for starting the conflict, whereas most of the commentaries and editorials in the rest of the Muslim world see Israel as the prime mover in the conflict.
Now, you mentioned problems in Pakistan. In Indonesia, where they're living with another tsunami and hundreds of victims, you say that they're also devoting a lot of attention to Lebanon.
Yes, they are. In fact, Indonesia has a fair number of editorials and commentaries condemning the United States specifically, even more than Israel, for the U.S. perceived role in the crisis. Actually, the way that the Indonesian papers are presenting it, the U.S. could call an end to the Israeli attacks at any time, but has chosen not to. That's a theme that we saw in a paper out of Jakarta, which is called Compass. We also saw it in another Indonesian paper called Republika, where they're saying the Israeli Zionists backed by the U.S. government are, and they go on to list a number of alleged crimes. They're saying that Israel is using chemical weapons and that it's raining hell down on Lebanon and that kind of thing. Also in that region of Asia, Malaysia, which is another mostly Muslim country, is full of editorials condemning the United States for its failure to intervene. They speak Malay and Chinese in Malaysia. And one of the Chinese language papers, the Guangming Daily out of Petaling Jaya, says the U.S. strong support for Israel is the chief culprit, indirectly causing the deterioration of the conflict. It controls Israel. Why can't it make Israel stop? That's a theme that we've seen sort of all across the Muslim world. And the funny thing is that this is actually sort of a reverse of a theme that we've noticed in other editorials that say that Israel controls U.S. foreign policy. In this case, it's that the U.S. can control Israeli foreign policy, so why isn't it doing so?
Let's come back to Israel, which, you know, as of last week, you told us was still kind of anguished in its take on this invasion. Tell me what is being said in the papers there now.
It has changed in a week. last week, many of the papers left, right, and center in Israel were busy giving pros and cons. What could go wrong here? Should we have done this? Should we continue doing it? That kind of thing. This week, we were seeing much more sort of a grim, practical, get through it kind of mentality. The centrist paper, Yediot Aharonot, started off just saying, we have to destroy Hezbollah's missile capabilities. That is the purpose of this war. And if we fail, then the West will return to the policy, this is a quote now, the policy of buying calm with money and rewarding terrorists with silence. Then Haaretz, which is a leftist Israeli paper, also uses very similar language. They say, if at war's end the impression is that Hezbollah was damaged, but that it also managed to strike a heavy blow to Israel, the implication will be that the Israeli Defense Force has failed to restore its ability to deter. And that word deter is being used all over the Israeli press right now. The emphasis is really on restoring the fear in the Islamic world of the Israeli military. A center-right paper, Ma'ariv, said the same thing, this exact same words. If we fail to achieve the objectives of this war, it will be another victory, the biggest, for Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah. And this is definitely the theme that all Israeli papers are saying now. We're in it. We're in the conflict. And all we can do is pursue it until it's finished and not worry about right or wrong right now.
Okay, Susan. Well, once again, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Susan Kasky is the international editor of The Week magazine.
In the effort to win Middle Eastern hearts and minds, the United States has, in the last 4 years, launched two media outlets, the satellite TV channel Al Hura and Radio Sawa. Created solely for the purpose of propaganda, or public diplomacy, as it's now called, they can't air here, only overseas. But since winning the goodwill of their target audience is seen as vital, the U.S. Congress spends more than $70 million a year to keep them afloat. Nevertheless, a Zogby poll last year revealed that more than half that target audience never watches Al Hura, and we've heard many times anecdotally that Sawa draws listeners only for the music, never the news.
This week, that anecdotal impression was reinforced by a study conducted by Mohammed El-Nawawi, a communications professor at Queen's University of Charlotte, North Carolina. He surveyed nearly 400 college students from Morocco, Kuwait, Jordan, the United Arab Emirates, and the Palestinian territories to gauge how those media outlets ranked in terms of news credibility. Now, before we get to the results, let's talk quickly about the study's methodology. Kenneth Tomlinson, chairman of the Broadcasting Board of Governors, which runs both Radio Sawa and Al Hura, said the study was fatally flawed. He said the sample was both too small and skewed because nearly half those polled were Palestinian. Professor El-Nawawi acknowledged those concerns, but says that the study was approved by a blind peer review before it was published in the August issue of the academic journal Global Media and Communication.
So I think that speaks volumes of the quality of the study. Regarding the sample, I surveyed 394 Arab college students from 5 Arab countries, and I think that's a relatively good size considering that I'm an individual researcher, I'm not an organization. As far as the Palestinian representation in the sample, it just happened that way. I relied on what we call a convenience sample, meaning that whoever is available at the time of conducting the research to take the questionnaires, and it just happened that the Palestinians represented more than, 40%.
The potential problem with a convenience sample being that it's not random and it doesn't project against an entire population.
This is something that I reported in my study, and of course I reported the limitation of using a convenience sample, that you cannot take that to generalize to the population, but at least it gives you a sense. It serves as an exploratory study more than a study that you can take the results from and generalize to the population at large.
Okay, so let's talk about your findings. 70% of the people you polled said they tuned in to Radio Sawa. 37% said they watched Al Hura. But of those students who reported listening to Radio Sawa, 43% said they listened for music. Just 13% said they tuned in for news.
But the other major finding is that there were low credibility averages for Radio Sawa and television Al Hura. In fact, students' attitudes toward the U.S. foreign policy have worsened slightly since exposure to Sawa and Al Hura. And I think the explanation for that is that in their minds, they associated both networks with the U.S. government. And as you know, in the Middle East, Arab people have always been critical of their own media for conveying only one point of view, the official point of view. So that's why when you try to influence their opinions with networks that they associate with a certain government, that is bound not to be as successful.
So the very knowledge that these networks are being sponsored by the U.S. government makes them suspicious to the target audience.
That's exactly right. In addition to that, because at least the students I surveyed were aware that these networks were launched to try to influence their opinion or change their opinion, it reflected negatively on their perception of the credibility of its news.
Okay, fair enough. But the people at the Broadcast Board of Governors say that that is exactly why they have taken such pains to play it straight, to be as fair and objective and even-handed as humanly possible in the news broadcasts that they deliver, so as to disarm that reflexive suspicion about propagandists. Have you spent enough time listening to and watching these channels to know whether the U.S. government is keeping its word on that?
I cannot watch television Al-Hurra here, but I've been listening to Radio Sawa online. Of course, I like their music, but I think the news is trying to be objective. I don't think I have a problem with any bias in the news, but I don't think that's the problem. The problem is the perception. Perception can sometimes be more important than reality. And I believe as long as the Arab people can associate Radio Sawa with the U.S. government, they will always perceive it as not credible. That's the problem. The study is not questioning the efforts of the BBG. I think they need to be commended for these efforts. But I believe that what was mostly needed in this case was having some independent media outlets addressing the Arab audience, you know, from an impartial and balanced perspective rather than having the association with the U.S. government or the U.S. administration. I think that's where the problem is. If I also may add something, public opinion is shaped more by the substance of the policy than by how the policy is sold through public diplomacy. In other words, no matter how successful a public diplomacy effort is, as long as people are dissatisfied with, you know, what they're seeing on the ground, chances are they're not going to change their opinions through public diplomacy.
Or as it's often said, the best advertising in the world can't sell a bad product.
Exactly right.
So if the Arab street doesn't like the product, ain't no Radio Sawa going to change their minds.
Right.
Okay, Mohammed. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Professor Mohammed El-Nawawi teaches in the Communications Department at Queen's University of Charlotte in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Coming up, the president's first veto befuddles one reporter, and read all about it. The tabloid war will be televised.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. It wasn't the top story this week, but on Wednesday, President Bush, for the first time, vetoed a bill that would have loosened restraints on government funding for embryonic stem cell research. The president imposed those restrictions in 2001 and promised he would veto any legislative effort to lift them.
This bill would support the taking of innocent human life in the hope of finding medical benefits for others. It crosses a moral boundary that our decent society needs to respect, so I vetoed it.
Most media time this week was spent on the Middle East, but that doesn't mean the White House didn't take a stab at framing the conversation. Jake Tapper is senior national correspondent for ABC News, and he noticed that the White House press releases on the issue have contained decidedly mixed messages. Jake, welcome to OTM.
Thanks. It's a pleasure.
Tell us briefly what it is that the president vetoed.
The House and the Senate had both voted to allow federal funding of research, medical scientific research, that uses stem cells taken from embryos. And these are embryos, it should be pointed out, from fertility clinics. They are unused embryos that are frozen and otherwise generally are disposed of as medical waste, a few thousand every month.
Now, when the president imposed his restrictions in 2001, he said that government money could be directed to researching a limited number of existing embryonic stem cell lines. Can you explain what that means?
Sure. It means that when the president made his decision, what he called a middle ground decision in August 2001, he said that those embryos that had already been destroyed, the life or death decision had been made, therefore the research on those lines could continue. But no further federal funding would go to any more research on any new lines, meaning no new destruction of embryos. But here's the really interesting point with the White House. Throughout the 2004 campaign, they were very sensitive whenever John Kerry said that they were implementing a ban on federal funding of stem cell research. They always pointed out, look, we grandfathered in these existing stem cell lines. And in fact, the White House, as recently as this week, was heralding, these are quotes now from their own press releases, President Bush is the first president to ever fund embryonic stem cell research. President Bush's stem cell policy has made federally funded stem cell lines widely available to scientists. They're talking about how great it is that they're doing this. And in the same week, White House Press Secretary Tony Snow calls destroying an embryo murder, a legal term, and the president vetoed this against the wishes of the House, the Senate, and according to polls, 60% of the American people. Now, my question is, if one thinks that the destruction of a fertilized egg or an embryo is murder, and that is certainly a morally defensible position, but if you think that, then why are you bragging on a different page on your website about funding research of those murdered embryos?
If the administration had its way, how do you think it would want this story to be covered? One press release for one constituency, one for another?
Well, first of all, the White House knows how this is going to be covered, which is president stands in the way of medical progress. That's not their view of it, but they think that the so-called liberal media will portray it that way. But with the conflicting messages that they're putting out the same day, the same communication shop, I think they're hoping that swing voters who will decide important elections in Missouri and Ohio and elsewhere in this country this November, that swing voters will hear, no, the president is reasonable. He's taken this common sense approach down the middle, and he supported the grandfathered stem cell lines to continued studying and continued research. And then for the base, the president took a stand and is in favor of banning this horrible, outrageous procedure outright. What's so odd about it is this White House is usually so good at staying on message and having one consistent, coherent point of view, even if you disagree with it. And I almost even wonder if there's some rogue elements in the White House communication shop that support this research and are putting out these press releases unbeknownst to Tony Snow and the president.
That's the rogue only elements in the White House press office? You must be joking.
Well, I doubt it just because it is such a disciplined operation. But I have no idea why they're doing this. It is completely befuddling to me.
So do you think that taking this sort of hydra-headed position puts the administration into a bit of a corner?
This is a White House usually known for its discipline and for being able to very successfully portray their view in stark, black and white, often moral terms. But in this, he's trying to have it both ways, or his White House communication chap is trying to have it both ways. And it's, to me, incoherent.
So in this case, the president really can't have it both ways, in your view. And the moderate position that he's going to have to cope with ultimately is the one that's represented by, say, Nancy Reagan, who's anti-abortion but pro-embryonic stem cell research.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, this is about, for a lot of people, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, diabetes, neurological problems. This is about people that you know that too many of us know. So it becomes very personal for a lot of people when it comes to a tangible human being you know versus something in a test tube.
Jake, thanks very much.
That was my pleasure, Brooke.
Jake Tapper is a senior national correspondent for ABC News. Oh, what a lovely war of words.
I get up in the morning, buckle on the sword, and go out and fight the post. They have no mercy, those people. And neither do we. We put our foot on their throat every day and press down till their eyes bulge and leak blood, but still they won't die.
That's Michael Cook, recently departed editor-in-chief of the New York Daily News, in a clip from Bravo's new reality show, Tabloid Wars. The series, which debuts Monday, was a real coup for the Daily News in its long-standing war with the New York Post. Now, the Post says that it turned Bravo down, but Bravo denies that. It camped out at the Daily News, rolling cameras day and night from May to October, and it found, or made, heroes of several of the ink-stained wretches therein. Even the worst of them appeared at least human, and that's quite a feat in this media-loathing age.
I think it's good for people to come into the sausage factory and see what happens in newsrooms. I mean, what people will find, I think, is that the reporters are not these horrible, cynical people. I expect they will see people in some anguish over whether to run stories or not, and what pitches to run, how to present those stories. I think they'll be impressed by that. And we might move up on the likability charts a couple of notches.
Topping that chart, city reporter Kerry Burke, former rock critic, former punk band manager, former Bostonian.
Daily News.
We caught him at the office, where he often isn't. He's what they call a runner, the guy who pounds the pavement hour after hour in pursuit of the crucial quote.
Very often, people who don't read the paper walk up to me and say, you're capitalizing on these people's misery. And what they don't understand is that it isn't always just your daughter's been slaughtered. Mind if I can get a pick of the Vic and a taste of your heartbreak? It's not that cut and dry. We go out and we tell these people stories. And the fact that we do tell their stories is proof positive that not only that these people exist, but that they count. You know, they mean something.
Lots of times, he's on the scene just after bad things happen to good people, or bad people. It can be tough to get quotes from those people, tougher still when you're trailed by a camera crew.
I have to get into the building, I have to climb the stairs, I have to bang on the doors, I have to talk to people, I have to get people to talk to me on the record. I have to go in and have a hard look at some of the horrible things that have gone down. So now I've got a camera crew with me. So it was a more complicated way of doing my job, but we got it done.
Did you like it?
It was grueling. But, you know, it was a good idea because I go into people's lives every day of the week, very often on the worst day of their life. And I say, tell me everything. And then they do. So now these guys roll up with the camera and say, yeah, we want to shoot you doing your job. Basically, it was my turn. If it's good enough for the people I interviewed, then it's going to have to be good enough for me.
Did you...
Sorry.
Does he have to go?
There's I don't know what it is, but there's something at 28th and 11th ESU. And a source just called and said we should get there. So I told Frodo. Sorry. Just call me when you get out there, right?
Sure. Good luck.
Gregory Gittrich, deputy Metro editor, is the guy who sends him out. He sends everyone out. And he was wary when Bravo moved in. But that decision was made by higher-ups. Down in the newsroom...
No one was thrilled.
His big worry was that some source would be accidentally exposed.
we weren't concerned that it would happen intentionally. There was a concern that it would happen unintentionally, that by panning across the newsroom or by picking up a phone conversation, that they would out a source. There was also a great concern that it would be a standard cheesy reality show.
But Bravo put those fears on ice.
They agreed that once they got to the place where they had the footage that they thought might end up on the show, we'd get to watch the raw cuts solely to make sure that there wasn't any sourcing problems. The other side of it, the reality show side of it, there was no staging. We made it very clear to them that if they missed something, they missed it. There would be no, hey, can you do that again? And they had no intention, thankfully, of even making those requests.
No staging, though time frames were compressed and people talked in jump cuts with lots of edgy music. Not quite like life, but close enough, says General Assignment reporter Adam Lisberg.
They're going to think that nobody ever swaggers around like Carrie Burke, bangs on doors, gets people to talk, talks in this streetwise detective reporter lingo, but he does.
We understand there are racial elements. That's what the police say. If you've got a different version of events, then talk to me.
The Carrie Burke that you see on the screen is the Carrie Burke that we all see here.
Excuse me, I'm sorry to bother you. We're looking for folks who might know Nick Minucci.
You're Daily News.
I'm the Daily News.
You're not police.
No, I am the Daily News.
So, can you put my name in the paper?
If you want.
Lisberg says he was just as impressed by crime reporter Tony Sclafani in his star turn on the show, because Sclafani didn't get to cover a high-profile hate crime like Burke did in episode one. He had to wait for Christian Slater outside a Broadway production of The Glass Menagerie in the hope of a quote from the actor charged with groping an unknown woman's behind in a bodega.
A story is a story, and you know, if you're going to show what life is like at the Daily News, you have to show us working the stupid, pointless stories, too. I thought Tony behaved with absolute grace in that segment.
Hey, guys. My name's Tony from the Daily News. Did you guys hear about the Christian Slater thing?
Yes.
Was he on stage?
Yes.
He was.
And when he came out on stage, the whole audience started applauding.
He never made a gesture of pinching, right?
He did.
When?
If you had said to me on my last night before my wedding that I had to spend hours late at work standing on a sidewalk to try to get a quote from a third-rate star accused of a third-rate groping, I would have been screaming and yelling. I thought Tony behaved with absolute aplomb.
Especially when a passerby chewed him out in front of Bravo's cameras.
If Christian Slater comes out, if he says something, it's big news.
This is not news! News is thousands of people getting killed in Iraq because Bush lied. This is nonsense.
The guy screaming on the streets got a point.
Adam Lisberg.
But we got a rock in the paper every day. You know, every dead soldier who dies in New York, it's a race to get out there and tell their story. But also people buy the paper because they want to read gossip and they want to read about celebrities. And, you know, we got to give it all time. And I think the Daily News is a great value. You get everything you got to know. You get your comics. You get two crosswords. You know, you get an awful lot for 50 cents.
Gossip is a big part of what the Daily News offers. It's the great leveler. Sure, the paper shows ordinary people doing extraordinary things, but it also shows extraordinary people doing ordinary things, dumb things. There's value in reporting that, right? But not necessarily in front of the cameras.
They had to really fight and talk me into it because at first I thought it was going to be, you know, Carrie Burke and I climbing walls of Jell-O or something.
Joanna Malloy is half of the durable husband and wife gossip column team of Rush and Malloy. She had the unsettling experience of watching herself make journalistic sausage. Did you see the episodes, the ones they made available to critics, the two of them?
I couldn't bring myself to watch the second one all the way through. My palms would start sweating every single time, but I did see the first one, yes.
And your reaction?
I need to go on a diet is one. You know, because it's NPR, I'm going to be completely honest. I do feel that I look like a bit of a flibbertigibbet. See, I always rationalize to myself, well, if I do this column, I can help liberal causes. And, you know, when you have a page in a major metropolitan daily every single day, you try to do some good. But you know, what I'm shown doing is like talking about the fact that Howard Stern has to clean his doggies hindquarters because the dog can't reach it. And I thought, I have a lot of reflection to do. I think that through their lens, I saw myself more clearly. And really 90% of the job is writing about the expansion and contraction of Britney Spears's posterior and, you know, the spats between Lindsay Lohan and Paris Hilton. And I just don't know if it's worth it anymore.
You're not saying that this has brought a crisis of conscience to Malloy.
It has. No, it has. I think that these were very serious documentary makers, and the stuff that they selected to put in has really been an eye-opener for me. And so I have really been examining myself ever since.
You're the first person I've spoken to here who has said that or maybe admitted that.
That's because Carrie Burke and Greg Gitchards have nothing to be ashamed of.
But does Malloy? It's up to every viewer to judge, because as tricked up as some of the action is, Tabloid Wars really does offer a taste of how that paper looks and sounds. Not like the New York Times, more like a Dickens novel, sentimental and sordid and serialized as Dickens was in weekly newspapers. Only this is a daily, and it only has one character, and that's the city. You don't like seeing the sausage being made? You won't like Tabloid Wars. You prefer the Times? Lots of people don't like Dickens either.
Yeah, Carrie Burke speaking. Hey, how are you, brother? Okay, that dude on the roof, turns out he was partying with some friends last night, had a few too many drinks, and passed out at a joint called The Eagle. I think it's a leather bar. Right. We don't want to call it a leather bar if it's not a leather bar. I'm looking at online bar reviews. Plenty of humpy men clad in leather, Levi's and uniforms. So we can call it a leather bar. Okay, I'll catch you later.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Vuolo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had engineering help this week from Rob Christensen and other assistants from Claire Peters and Noah Kuman. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by Ciaobella Gelato, purveyors of all-natural gelato and sorbet. Ciaobella is available nationwide at specialty food markets. More information at ciaobellagelato.com or 1-800-GELATO-3. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. And thanks.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.